We are looking at balance throughout this weekend, and we started by talking about the role that respect plays, respect for your spouse, in having the right kind of balance. And then we talked about time and media, balancing that in order to have a balanced marriage. And so we're going to continue that thought today. And in this session, we're going to be talking about balancing our roles in marriage. And it may not be that this is such an early start, but that's such a popular topic as to why we... I had a few who haven't showed up today. They're going to wait till that session's over and come in after that. It's really fun when I do premarital counseling. One of the first homework assignments that I do is I assign Ephesians chapter 5 to the prospective bride and groom. But what I do in that first session is I give the verses to the man, to the woman, and say, I want you to write me about a paragraph telling me what Paul is saying that the man's role is. And so she'll come back and she'll duly give her report, you know, and talk about how he is to love and what that means, as Christ loved the church. And, you know, she's got the longer section there. And then I really delight, I guess a little twisted way, to give that other text to the guys and say, I want you to tell me what that means. And, of course, it's talking about subjection or submission. I love to watch those guys squirm, almost without exception, because of what society says and because of some bad pictures and some of the anecdotal evidence about men who are oppressive. You know, they don't want to be that guy, especially to the woman who's about to be their wife. And so they downplay that, you know, subjection, but, you know, that's, and so they hem and haw. It's because we have a lot of confusion on this subject, and this is a needed topic. Now, I want to start in perhaps somewhat of an unusual way. A fellow by the name of Robert Hickey, who is the deputy director of the Protocol School of Washington, he wrote a book entitled Honor and Respect, the Official Guide to Names, Titles, and Forms of Address. First of all, I wonder how a guy gets a job like that, the deputy director of protocol in Washington. And then he has the mind to write a book on titles. And what he deals with that's the most interesting to me is the distinction or the rules that govern the use of the title the honorable. Have you ever heard that used? If you watch TV, sometimes on crime and drama shows, talk about the honorable. But I didn't realize that there are some set rules as to how you use that title. Maybe you did, but here are a few of the tips that he gives with regard to that. He says, you don't use the term with other titles, like the honorable doctor so-and-so. It's one or the other. You don't do those together. And you don't use the honorable without using the person's full name. Did you know that? So it would be the Honorable Gary Neal Pollard Jr., if you would wish to address me that way. So there's rules about that. And it sounds a little stiff, doesn't it? It sounds a little uptight. But I like this appeal to dignity and decorum in our laid-back, casual world. That there's a desire to preserve some honor. And while that won't affect most of our lives, the Bible talks a lot about the need for us to be honorable. In fact, when you begin to look through Scripture, Scripture praises honor repeatedly. For example, just to get your mind started on this. In the Philippians chapter 4 and verse 8, we are to think honorable things, among other matters. We are to honor our parents, right? Exodus chapter 20 and verse 12, that's said again in Ephesians chapter 6, and that's an honor that can continue even after we leave the home. We are to honor the aged, Moses would say in Leviticus chapter 19 and verse 32. We are to honor the Lord. We'll come back to that in Proverbs chapter 3 and verse 9. And over and over and over again, the Bible talks about how honorable it is for us to have honor in what we do. The honor that comes to the wise and to the righteous. And so while being one who is honorable may involve with the idea of being honored, the idea of being honorable can't be reduced to some kind of formal title or some way of acting that causes people to praise you. We're talking about honoring the roles that God has given for us. And when we look at that word honorable, it means bringing or being worthy of honor. You might remember that it was kind of big to talk about Jabez a few years ago. And 1 Chronicles chapter 4 and verse 9 says that Jabez was honorable, literally recognized as one who was weighty and substantial. He was respected. And the New Testament word means fitting and good, and you'll find it used in passages like 2 Corinthians chapter 8 and verse 21 and Philippians chapter 4 and verse 8. But I want us to talk about how we honor one another as husbands and wives. And we're going to talk mainly about honoring one another through the roles that we play. But I also want to add in there some material with regard to honoring the vows that God has given us to meet in marriage and how we honor God by honoring our roles. So having said that, let's start with that. The first thing we want to see in this session this morning is that we need to honor the roles that God has given to us. All right, so the roles of male and female are different. If you were to try to capture some of the main things that God has told a woman to do in marriage, what would it include? I gave you one of them. All right, to be in subjection to the husband. What else? Women, as you think in terms of the role that you play in your marriage. All right, to be a helper, a helpmeet. What else? To be a keeper of the home, Titus chapter 2 and verse 5. The manager thereof. What else? All right, to respect her husband. You know, so often we do that, don't we? We reduce it to one task apiece. It's love and be in subjection. But it takes in more than that. Yes, sir? Okay. And so what you'll see in a lot of those is there's an intersection, right? There's something that the wife is to do for the husband. It's the same thing the husband is to do for the wife. There's a mutual commitment. There's a mutual responsibility that they have to one another. But as you think about the roles that God has given to man and woman, they're different. What role has God given to the man? All right, to be the spiritual leader. And I think it's very interesting that you didn't lead out with what Paul does in that analogy of the church, where he compares the church to the husband-wife relationship, or uses that as an illustration of the church. But he is to be the spiritual leader. Tim Farrer wrote a book. It's another good resource. It's called The Point Man. And it's more than about being a husband, guys. It's about being a father. And those who have served in time of war know how there are individuals who are appointed over a certain number of people, especially in combat. And they're referred to as point men. And Farrer uses that illustration to say that he is responsible for getting whoever is in his charge from place to place. He is to make sure that he provides for their safety and he protects them every way that he can. And so that leadership role is one that he takes very seriously. God has made man the point man of the home. There's going to be a special sense in which we stand before the Lord on the judgment day to give an account for what we've done. And we'll talk more about that in a moment. So leadership. What else? Provide. 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse 8. Lead, provide.
Cherish.
Okay, that's right out of Ephesians chapter 5. Nourishes and cherishes as he does his own body.
It's similar to what you're talking about, the point man, but being the head of the household.
Okay. All right, so it's kind of the companion idea. You have the subjection, you have headship. And with that comes the responsibility to be the spiritual leader. It's not the dictatorship, but it is one who can be counted on to lead the home in the direction it should go. To be one that can be trusted and be entrusted with that responsibility. Anything else? All right, and you have this powerful description of love. We're going to come back and talk about that. You have the love that's the love like Christ loved the church. And so often we think in the dramatic terms, right? Because Jesus loved to the extreme. It was a giving love. It was a love that caused him to sacrifice to the point of death. And I think every man in this room would say, and faced in that situation, that we would do that. We would die for our wives. We would die for anybody in our families. But it's not usually that dramatic. It doesn't come down to that kind of a decision. It's that day by day living before them and living with them that has to have that demonstration of Christ likeness. All right, so we see that there are multiple ideas involved in the roles that God has given to us. But I want to break it down and look and see that God gave roles from the beginning. And they were meant to be different. And you remember that God made the woman to be a helper. That was one of the first things that was said that was suitable for her husband. Genesis chapter 2 and verse 18. The literal idea there is one who is a counterpart. And it's one of the wonders and the amazement of how God did not create marriage so that one could complete the other. You hear young people say that sometimes, but that's not true. It's to complement one another. We need to be two complete people that come together and fill in those and are counterparts for, not to make somebody complete emotionally because they're not that until they're married. That's going to create problems in a marriage. That's such a dependency that they can't stand on their own two feet, but those two complete people come together and they depend on one another. In every worthwhile effort, then, there's going to be a need for well-defined roles to occur. How can two people, or two creatures as diverse as male and female, function so well that God says that they are to be one flesh? And the answer lies in the distinctive roles that God gave to each of them from the very beginning. And I want you to notice that God has designated the husband as the leader of the home. From a biblical standpoint, why did God make man the head of the house? In 1 Timothy chapter 2, there's at least three reasons given. Now, he's talking about the background of 1 Timothy. 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 15. Paul is saying, if I tarry long to Timothy, that I write these things unto you so that you may know how one ought to conduct himself in the house of God, which is the church of the living God, the pillar and support of the truth. And that's kind of how you understand 1 Timothy. And so as you begin from the beginning and you work your way through the book, he's dealing with relationships and roles. Now in 1 Timothy chapter 2, in context, he's dealing with the fact that woman in the context of the household of God is to not teach or to have authority over the man, but she's to learn in quiet submissiveness. But you have a reason given behind this that is lifted out of the church context. It's why we know that it wasn't just a problem in Ephesus in the first century, but it's something that's meant for all generations, all times, all cultures, all situations. So what does Paul do to establish the fact that these roles ought to exist in the way that they are? How does he illustrate it?
Adam was the first man.
Adam and Eve. They were not part of the first congregation. They were part of the first family, right? And so he lifts this out and he makes a contextual point about how things are to function in the home. And what does he say? Somebody gave us the first reason why a man has been given that role.
Adam was first.
All right, so there's order of creation. In 1 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 13, for Adam was first formed than Eve. All right, so what's the second thing? All right, there's the nature of sin. In 1 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 14, the woman was deceived by the devil's tricks. Man went with his eyes wide open. He's not held in higher honor. But that's a reason given by Paul. And there's the fact, I guess it's implied here more than it is stated, and that's the order of sin. The woman sinned first. We go, okay, how does that relate to relationships in 21st century? I don't know, but I know that this is what the Apostle Paul said in establishing what he's saying in 1 Timothy chapter 2. And so God has designated the role of man being the head for this reason, but there's a practical idea involved as well. Somebody has got to be in charge. Boy, I know, somewhere hackles will come up and there's because of the terminology. But for lack of a better way of putting it, there's the idea. How many of you guys are old enough to remember Eastern Flight 401 that went down in the Everglades in the early 70s? Did you ever hear the story behind why that plane went down? I'm sure some of you had to. You have a pilot and a co-pilot in the cabin. But on that particular night, there were two extra folks. One was deadheading, and there was another guy who happened to be up there just observing the flight. They were flight engineers. Smart guys. And of course, to be flying a flight that crosses interstate lines, you got to have so many hours. And so these are experienced pilots. And the pilot himself was in his 50s, so he had a lot of years of flying time. And they're flying this particular jet, and it's a nighttime flight. And there's just an indicator light in the cockpit that's out. And so they're trying to figure out if the wheels had come down on the plane. And so those flight engineers particularly down in that hole trying to see to determine whether or not the wheels have come down, but there's no light down there. And so that you rely on that indicator light in the cabin. And what they think is because of the two sticks, the pressure was set different on the co-pilots and the pilots. And so they think maybe the co-pilot bumped it when he got up earlier in the flight. So it knocked that light off. And so you got four men, four very smart men, who are trying to figure out whether or not the wheels had landed or not. And they're trying to figure out, is there something wrong with the light? Or has something happened? And so they're doing this the whole time. And the co-pilot, having bumped off the autopilot, caused that plane to begin to descend. And nobody knew until it was too late. Now, not everybody died on that flight, but a lot did. All because, and here's the last statement in the NTSB report. Preoccupation with the malfunction of the nose landing gear position indicating system distracted the crew's attention from the instruments and allowed the descent to go unnoticed. In other words, the plane crashed because nobody was flying it. You know, in a lot of homes, if you were to try to say, who's flying the plane? There's not a good answer given to that. You see, God has said, He gives some biblical reasons for us to carry, to understand, to relate back to in 1 Timothy chapter 2. But He has said somebody needs to be in charge of flying the plane. And He's put man in that position. But let me ask you a question. What does it mean for the man to be the head of the wife? That's one of those kind of opaque terms. What does that mean, to be the head? Oh, that's a very good biblical answer, but what does that mean? You're right. No, that's good. But yeah, I'm not faulting it, but what does that mean?
Take responsibility.
All right. So what's an example? Where is an area in which he needs to take responsibility?
To care and build them up.
Okay, to care and to build up. All right, that falls to him.
It's what the wife and the family should look up to.
All right. All right, so wisdom, leadership,
provision.
I wonder if the ladies are just sitting on their answers here. We're going to flip it in just a minute, so it's fine. Yes? All right, there's back to our point man idea. That God says, man, you're who I'm looking at first. You're the one who should be providing. Now, you think about that in terms of what happens so often. So often, men, we have defaulted and allowed the women to take the lead in this. If there's a family devotion, she's the one who's going to do it. If there's Bible reading, if there's spiritual talk, it falls to her. To be the head, to take responsibility, to be as Christ is, means that falls to us. That we don't wait. Now, moms need to be involved because they're nurturers. And so often, they're, at least in some situations, she has more access to the children. And so she's a vital part. But men, that falls to us. God's going to ask about what happens in our homes and look to us and see what we did to be the head. Anything else that others look up to? Maybe we just don't think in these terms, but what about character? Because if my wisdom is going to be heeded, they want to be able to look at me and see, and I say they, not just the wife, but the children, want to be able to see that I'm consistent. That what I'm telling them to do is what I do. And look, this is all done through the prism of Romans chapter 7. We struggle. We don't do everything what we know is right. We do those things that we know we shouldn't. And nobody, mom, dad, husband, wife, nobody's going to do this perfectly. But we're striving on the whole to have the kind of character that our family can look to and see an example that they can follow. It's interesting, isn't it? What nobody has said here is that he is the decision maker when we talk about head. Now, have you ever heard the old analogy about it, that husband serves as the tiebreaker in a 1-1 split, you know, and so he serves it, and that's in line with what we're talking about. But let me tell you something. Kathy and I have been married 23 years. Something that I have observed is how extremely rare that kind of deadlock is. I mean, you go back and forth, right, and you talk, but what happens in the process of time may not be immediate, but you work through that, and you together come to a decision. That you're side by side. That's what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to work as complementing one another, complement, working to fill out. But what happens when you just hit that deadlock? The only time I can remember had to do with a decision to move somewhere over 20 years ago. And she had one place in mind, and as we dug through some of the variables, there was some concern about that, and we didn't make that move and move somewhere else. That's, as far as I can remember, that's it, where we had that deadlock. You see, so that's not really the bulk of where this is going to occur. And really it's pride that causes us to dig in the trenches and create those kind of dilemmas. Headship deals with character decisions and being spiritually responsible. Yes, sir. Right.
You always want to have at least
51-49.
So that one person can make the decision if you come to a point like that.
Yeah, and they're going to inevitably happen. And so God has created that. You know, you start in Ephesians 5:21. And I believe there's some import. There's the scholars are divided as to whether that goes with the other participles in Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 16, don't be drunk with wine, but be filled with the Spirit, verse 18, 19. And then you get down to verse 21, it says, and be subject to one another in the fear of Christ. But it's interesting that he goes from that into this discussion. However you want to look at that, there's a mutual subjection that takes place, that we bend to the will of others, and we don't all, no but one person should have their way all the time. So when we talk about roles in the home, we're not talking about the man should have his way all the time, or the woman for that matter. But here's when we begin to dig in Scripture, we see in how the husband is the head of the wife and how he is to lead the wife. Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 25 says, it is to be provided in love. That tempers the tone, and it tones the temper. When you look at it that way, that he is to provide a loving leadership. Number two, it is to be a leadership that, in a love that is equal to the love for his own life. Ephesians 5 and verse 28. Number three, it is to be patterned after Christ's love for the church. And man, it might be a good study for us in our personal Bible study to look and to drink in what all we see in the life of Christ and the Gospels, and we see in what the epistles look back on and talk about with regard to what Jesus did for the church. It's about what we do. It's about what we provide. Number four, it is to be provided free of bitterness. Colossians chapter 3 and verse 19. Well, here's a concept we're going to come back to before we're done today a couple of more times. Number five, it is to be done with understanding. 1 Peter 3 and verse 7. You talk about anybody who is in a position of leadership. You think for example, about we have some of our your elders here this morning. Elders, as they are shepherds of the sheep. Jesus in John chapter 10 talks about how the sheep won't follow the voice of a stranger. They've got to know the sheep. The shepherds do. And the sheep have got to feel comfortable with the shepherd. When we're talking about the leaderships that's to be provided, Peter's saying that you are to live with her in an understanding way. What does that require? How are you going to understand your wife, men? You got to be around some. You got to tune in to what is important to them and listen to the concerns that they have. And to be working together through those difficulties that come up in life or just the daily decisions that come along. Number six. It's to be done in full recognition of the equality of his wife in God's eyes. You see, in 1 Peter 3, 7, in the most important way, you are heirs together of the grace of life. When God looks down at your wife, he sees somebody as valuable as you are in every way. You just have a different role. All right, so how does a husband honor his wife in his role? The Bible says a lot about that. It says he will love and cherish her as he does his own body. Ephesians 5:28-29. 1 Peter 3 and verse 7 says that he will honor her. He will take the time necessary to really know her. That's 1 Peter 3, 7. Number four, he protects her from the things that would harm and hurt her. 1 Peter 3, 7. Number five, as was mentioned a moment ago, he will provide for all of her needs, including her physical needs. 1 Timothy 5 and verse 8. Number six, he will provide spiritual leadership. We've already mentioned that. Number next, he will treat her as an equal, respecting her good judgment and her talent. Titus 2 and verse 4. He will honor her above father and mother, Jesus says, Matthew 19 and verse 5. And he is to make her his one and only wife as long as she lives, according to Matthew 19 and verse 6. You know, you begin to look at how the world pictures a man and what it means to be a real man, and it glamorizes a man's sexuality. It will talk about his charm, his earning power, his physical strength, but it ignores and even ridicules the things that God expects of a man in a marriage relationship. All right, so we're done picking on the men for a while. Let's look at the ladies. God has given women a very important place in the home as well. You know, she often hears the world's sermon about her assertiveness and her independence and her rights. And then she comes to church and she hears sermons. And here's what she may hear. She may hear a sermon about her desire being for her husband as he shall rule over her. Genesis chapter 3 and verse 16. She hears sermons about being subject to her husband. Titus chapter 2 and verse 5. And if you have the Old King James, it says being obedient. Well, don't you like that? That's Titus 2, 5. Being submissive to her own husband, even unbelieving husbands. 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 1. In my experience, it seems that many Christian women regard subjection as bad-tasting medicine that's necessary for salvation but bitter to swallow. And sometimes the frustration can be added because it seems that the man is not interested in fulfilling the role that he has. And so she feels like she's the only one doing that. The wife is not to reform her husband. She's not to change his ways. But she is to willingly submit to him. But you know, there's something interesting that happens when a woman submits to her husband. Did you know that she meets one of his most important needs? When a wife submits to the husband, what need does she meet, do you know? What need of the man? Good, perhaps y'all hadn't thunk about this before. That's all right. Okay. That's a very negative way of talking about that, but you're not off completely. Ego. All right, elaborate on that. Okay. All right. Building his baser instincts, which would be what? Because. Okay, making him feel more like a man. You're all on top of that. That you are not wrong at all. And we'll talk. I'll fill out some of the spaces in that. What did you say?
The need for admiration.
Sense of worth. Did you know that? Did you know women are smart. Women are a lot smarter than we are, guys. It's true. It really is. I used to hear about left brain, right brain arguments in one fault from one side and one the other. And then I read a study from the APA that says that, did you know women actually think with both sides of their brain? That's why we can't win an argument. We're fighting with one half of our brain tied behind our cortex or whatever, you know. So it's a matter of her just kind of knowing that. But it really does. And however you want to say that, we feel the need to protect. And when there's that subjection saying, hey, I trust your leadership, it pulls that out of us. Because nobody abuses what there is there to nurture and protect. And so in fulfilling that role, God knew how He made both of us. He's the one that made us in that very broad way that way. And so when the wife is in subjection to her husband's leadership, she allows him to fill in and to protect and nurture and to take care. And an interesting thing is that she does not submit if. She submits because. Because God says that this is the best and the only way, and she will reap the benefits if she accepts God's will. She does it as unto the Lord, Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 22. By faith, she joyfully submits to His subjection, just as she lovingly accepts the protection and the leadership of Jesus as her Lord. But you know, here's what happens I've found so often. When it comes to the role of the man and the woman, what we do is we become police officers. We want to see if the other person is doing their job and they're following God's law. And so we kind of do a wait and see, right? We play a game of marital chicken. And I'm waiting. You got to bend so that I will. And if you don't, I won't. And what happens in a game of chicken if nobody yields? It's a pretty messy end, isn't it? And we have a lot of those things happening because we're waiting for the other one to do what they're supposed to do. A revolutionary way of thinking is, why don't we step up and do what we're supposed to do and see and have trust in God's plan for roles in the family and roles in the marriage, and see what happens with the other person. You know, God knows what He's doing when He sets up those roles in that way. Well, here's what I'm going to try. I have three sessions, but I also have a mountain of material you guys gave me. So I want to leave some room at the end for that. So even though we got started a little bit late, I'm going to build in a little break right here. And in 5 minutes, we're going to go in another direction. I have more material, obviously, on this, but I'm watching that clock. So let's take about a 5-minute break, and we'll go into our next session in just a few moments.